Hunger and the sight of plenty drove Edward Penderby from the streets at 9 o'clock on the night of that September 10th. London's heat, pulsing at wall and roof all afternoon and evening, had made the Lupus Street attic oven hot. He opened the window and the effort left him panting. Penderby was tired in body and mind, tired as only the workless on his futile quest can be. His underwear clung, the soles of his feet seared burning. The hunger pain had given way to an ache that throbbed between his eyes and the top of his head. Picture this, Penderby. Picture him as he lay, while the room darkened, on the soiled coverlid of the truckle bed. Lanky, ill-shaven, black hair in need of cutting, eyes quick even in defeat, suit now so ragged that any employer would have been repelled, and in dubious control a clever, savage brain scheming ever to no purpose. And ask why he was chosen. Whatever the quality of Penderby's faculties, worry and fatigue had numbed his mind beyond the power of directed thought that night, and he stared as unthinkingly as a human being can at the lamp-thrown window pattern taking shape on the slanted ceiling. When that pattern was sharpest, he had fallen asleep, one leg still hanging over the side of the bed, and it was 3 hours after the automatic extinguishing of the streetlights wiped the design away that he awoke. "If it weren't so infernally hot," he said, "I'd stay in bed." Then he saw that he had slept in his clothes, and he cursed. They would stick to his sweating skin more than ever. As he swung onto the edge of the bed, he felt the clamminess of them already. But he washed, tiptoed down through the fetid lodging house air, and stepped into the freshness of the street. He turned toward London's heart and walked slowly. What impelled him, what had caused him to leave his room so early and make a miserable day longer than it normally would have been, he did not know. The first body was outside a store at the corner. It was an old newspaper seller's, in a greasy blue suit that shone. Copies of the Evening Standard and the Star had fallen from his arms to the sidewalk. Penderby, determined not to be an inquest witness, hurried past. But beyond the corner was another body, a girl who had been standing in a doorway. Her body had folded into an attitude of a sleeper on the step, and her cigarette had burned away in the palm of one hand. There was no blood, so far as Penderby could see, but she might have been murdered. So might the old man, only a few feet away, and Penderby turned and ran. He stopped short to avoid a bundle of rags and what had been a slum harridan. He was frightened now. He retreated to the middle of the street and looked swiftly up and down. Two more bodies were about 50 yards away, and one was that of a policeman. "What in thunder is this?" Penderby asked aloud. "Am I awake anyway?" He undeniably was, and the bodies were still there. "They can't be asleep altogether," he said, "nor drunk. Look at that cop." But he went back to the sidewalk and touched the two bodies on it gingerly. He said, "Hey, wake up," and felt a little sacrilegious as he tried to shake what had been the girl. They were corpses, without a doubt. So, he found, were the bodies of the policeman and the well-dressed youth nearby. 5 bodies, and not noticed, apparently till now. "I don't give a damn," Penderby muttered. "Let someone else be a witness. I'd get no thanks for it, I bet." On he went. A pair of cats had died on the steps of a house. What he assumed to be the body of a man lay on the other side of the street. Let him lie there. He found himself counting the dead on Warwick Way. They seemed natural after a time. Most, at a distance, were dark bundles that matched the drab street. His astonishment gradually receded. It did not grow. It became a curtain in his awareness, new background that gave a new proportion. But he stopped now and then to ponder the astounding fact once more, and his thinking did not lessen the fact that these streets in the center of London were filled with dead. To one he did give heed. A girl, 17 or 18, had been leaning out of a first-story window, face cupped in hand. Her elbows had spread on the sill, and her fingers had slid into her yellow hair. Chin and part of one cheek rested on the stone slab. He ran to the door of the house. He pressed the bell, wielded the knocker till the street echoed. No one was aroused. "It's a plague," Penderby shouted. His voice was shrill. A sickly light sweat stood on his forehead. "It's a plague. It's got all the town, and it'll get me." But he began to reason, with the surprising coolness that marked most of what he did that day. He walked from one to another of six or seven bodies on the street. The expressions of the faces were those of persons who had tried to prevent themselves from slipping, from tripping, from being struck. There was no sign of panic, and there was no sign that anyone had run to aid anyone else. No, he concluded, if it was a plague, it killed everyone at once. But a plague couldn't do that. And anyway, how comes it that I'm here, after sleeping beside an open window all night? Then, but am I awake? He pinched the soft skin on the backs of his hands and turned several times, stamped and shook himself as if to fling a burden away. He was awake. These others had died. Edward Penderby was alive. He went on, his bearing less hesitant than before. 16 or 17 buses, passengers in all of them, drivers and conductors in a few, stood in the Victoria Railroad Depot yard. Penderby did not enter any of them. He noted a blue-uniformed group in a corner and remembered that drivers, conductors, and inspectors had gathered at the spot. There was no sound of trains. One, bearing travelers from the continent who had landed the evening before, had drawn in. Some doors were open, but the cars were still full. Outside were taximen dead, newsboys dead, policemen dead. Two bodies in German-cut clothes had fallen into a gutter. They were those of refugees, probably. Horror and alarm gained brief mastery, and Penderby fled the place. As he fled, Big Ben and cathedral bells began to peal the useless hour and made a clangor in his ears. He stopped only when his lungs seemed about to burst and his aching legs could not carry him farther. An automobile stood 6 feet from him. It was the first he had noticed. He stepped onto the running board, but he had to respect property, and he paused. "Is there anyone alive here?" he shouted. Then he bawled the question. There was no reply, and he slipped in. But the ignition had been locked and the key removed. He cursed in impatience, already different from the vexations of his months of struggle, and jumped out. A bigger automobile was ahead, and the driver had slumped onto the wheel. He opened the nearest door, turned the body off balance and guided it to the ground, seated himself at the wheel, and started the engine. The key had been lying on the floor. Bicycles, cars, and bodies blocked the way every few yards, so Penderby traveled slowly. He passed the Houses of Parliament and government buildings in Whitehall. Trafalgar Square contained more dead than even the space outside the depot. He spared them only a glance. The air was chill, and the hunger that sleep had held off had returned. He drove to a big restaurant 300 yards away, and somewhat timidly, despite all he had seen, walked in. The restaurant had been full. He halted at a table at which a middle-aged man had sat. On it were beef, ham, cakes, bread and butter, and a pot of tea. Standing, he snatched food in both hands, and as he ate wolfishly from one, the other was stretched for still more. But he could not eat as much as he had expected. His stomach had been used to little. He was thirsty. The long cold tea cut the saliva from his tongue. Still, it was bitter, and he set the pot, from which he had gulped, back with a crash. He remembered that he was in the less expensive section. He returned to the entrance hall, stepped over bodies of waiters and others, and went up the broad stairs. Bottles and glasses stood on a table near the cashier's desk in the second dining room. He poured a glass of wine. He swallowed it in a second, poured and drank another, and a little less quickly, another. His body began to tingle. He lost awareness of blistered feet and sticky clothes. "This is more like it," said Penderby. Bottle and glass on knees, he sat on a chair he had drawn a little apart and mused in a mingling of contentment and glee. His mind suddenly seized on the fact that the dead he faced had been more than well-to-do. He leaped onto the chair, waved bottle and glass aloft, and cried, "Silence!" His voice mounted to a sing-song screech. "Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, you simply cannot know the pleasure it gives me to be with you this morning. There's a slight difference, to be sure, between your standing and mine just now, but you're big enough to overlook it, aren't you? Well, ladies and gentlemen of the upper crust, I give you..." There Penderby paused. "What do I give you?" He rubbed his forehead with the wet bottle spout. "I've got it. I give you discontent, disappointment, starvation, clothes the dogs bark at, and a happy death." He drank the toast, sent bottle and glass sliding and spinning along the waxed floor, and ran down the stairs. He was exhilarated as never before. He was triumphant. The Strand, London's most famous thoroughfare, which leads from Trafalgar Square to Fleet Street, was strewn with dead. They had fallen at bus stops, in late-shutting stores, lights in some of these burned still, on pedestrian crossings, in buses and automobiles that had crashed against one another, and in places formed a barrier from wall to wall. Here and there, wheels had squeezed blood into oozy patches. A bus had shattered a cafe window and spilled cakes and pastries onto the sidewalk. Another had snapped an electric light post, and wires lay in curls and tangles for 60 yards. One wing of a Rolls-Royce, a white-haired woman in the back, had littered a section of pavement with the plate glass of a clothing store. Penderby climbed in, and in 10 minutes was wearing a tweed jacket, flannel trousers, a gray shirt, light underwear, clean socks, and a yellow belt. He took a pair of brown shoes from a store nearly opposite, and then sought the effect in a mirror in the dim rear. "I don't look too bad," he commented, considering everything. He went back to the street, and now to see what's become of the rest of the 8 million. Penderby had begun to utter his thoughts. But it was not in fear, so far as he knew at least, nor was he lonely after this inexplicable departure of his fellow creatures. He picked his way among the dead for about half a mile. The number decreased as he neared Fleet Street, and he took a bicycle from the doorway of a store and rode, with little difficulty, into London's Newspaper Row. The stare of what had been a policeman at a lamppost near the court buildings brought him up with a jerk that nearly threw him off the machine. For a moment, he thought that another had been spared, but the eyes did not move. Only for a waste paper bin, shoulder high, on the pole and his straddling legs, the policeman would have fallen as he died. Penderby was slightly hungry when he came to a corner lunch counter, so he climbed over the bar, mixed a milkshake as he had seen the attendants do, and drank it between bites of a stale ham sandwich. He rode on and dismounted at a newspaper office. He walked in. The front office contained 12 or 14 bodies, three or four those of clerks. He climbed the marble and concrete stairs two at a time. He had searched two corridors when he opened a door marked newsroom. There were bodies at nearly half the desks, and one had fallen beside the half-open door of a telephone booth in which the instrument hung the full length of the cord. A head pressed the keys of a typewriter on a desk near, and some of the type bars were in midair. Penderby pulled a sheet of paper from the machine. The word Churchill and the number 3 were in the top left corner. He read, "Mr. Churchill declared that he did not favor any attitude, policy, or frame of mind that could be construed as containing even the germ of what has been called encirclement, but that he would oppose any attempt..." No more. "Good God," murmured Penderby. He moved to the desk alongside. A young man had begun a story about loan failure. He had typed a line of hyphens through said and substituted asserted. Penderby went to all the other desks occupied. No one had been writing of death. How could they have known, after all, he reasoned. It probably got everyone at the same time. It must have. He wandered through the composing room and down a spiral metal staircase to the pillared press room. The remote bulb still glared. In the light diluted by mud-spattered wire-netted windows, they did little but bring glints to the shiny parts of the machines. One press had run off an early edition. It had continued to run, it seemed, long after those who had tended it died. A hill of papers hid the little gate out of which they had come. A man in dungarees had been leaning against a steel pillar of another machine. A face-high metal button shone on the pillar. It had been handled often. Penderby pressed it, and the machine began to roll. He retreated to the door as the rush of paper merged with a thunderous hammering, then returned and lifted one of the papers already carried out. The main story was about Russia and Germany. "If they could have waited," he said, "they'd have had a bigger story than that. But I suppose they couldn't. They had to go with the rest." The press still ran, and the concrete floor vibrated. The sight and the sound of it, with the recollection of what he had seen in the newsroom, stirred something akin to pity in the man. Brains, hands, metal here had been working when death had come, and if ever the product of journalism had been of fleeting value, it was now. Penderby did not know how to stop the press, and the noise irritated him after a while. He found the rear exit, a grimy steel-grilled door that opened onto a lane. He turned right, the direction in which a number of tracks had been turned, and found himself on Fleet Street again. His throat was parched, and he decided to look for more drink. Beer would be best, for the forenoon was hot. He filled two big glasses in a saloon, brought them out, placed them on the curb, and sat beside them in the sunlight. This time, he drank slowly. He had slipped a newspaper into a jacket pocket, and he idly read and drank for half an hour. The day was serene and had brought an air purer than London had breathed in a century. The man to whom all London, if not all Britain, had passed, dropped the paper. For he had noted that purity of the air, he wondered how long it would last. The street contained enough corpses to start a plague after another day or so. He could not bury them, not to mention the rest of the 8 million in Greater London. "I suppose," Penderby decided, "that I'll have to leave. Well, it wouldn't take long to get out by car. But where? The countryside, in all likelihood, would be as perilous as the city. No district in Britain was thinly populated." "Oh, the hell with it," was his conclusion. Having dismissed the problem for the moment, he went into the saloon for more beer. He was tired, and it was nearly noon when he stretched himself and decided to explore farther. Only a little farther, for the heat was intense. He cycled across Ludgate Circus, at the end of Fleet Street, and up Ludgate Hill. Dead, as he had expected, everywhere, silence complete, save for the faint noise of the bicycle. He was in the financial center. This region of swarming clerks and dull buildings had interested him little at any other time, and only the coolness of narrow streets between high gray walls induced him to go in now. The bodies he saw were few. Life normally had left the district with the closing of offices at 5 p.m. Ahead was a bank. He dismounted at the curb in front of it. A gate stood between sidewalk and door. The windows were high, deep, and barred. "If I weren't so tired," Penderby reflected, "I'd go in, even if it took a month." The place could tell him nothing, he saw. As he rode back to the Strand, he pondered the fact, the most illuminating so far as his new life was concerned, that the district of money was the least useful in all London. Penderby was sleepy now, though it still was early afternoon. The stimulus of wine and beer had worn off, and the alcohol made him drowsy. He cycled as far as a luxury hotel, before which taxis and limousines had been busy the night before, left the machine tilted against one of the glass doors, and walked in. Some of the well-dressed guests had died in armchairs, others on divans. More, standing, had fallen in groups that even now, somehow, told of their easy, unvexed lives of conversation and travel. Penderby, glancing around, was glad that the bitterness in him had not died. The first door he opened after he went upstairs moved only a few inches. Something had fallen against it. On the floor of the next room was the body of a man. A woman and a little girl had died in another. The fourth was empty. A door in it led to a bathroom. He turned the hot water on. It still was at boiling point, and as he waited till it had cooled, he shaved with a good sharp razor someone had left on the dressing table. Penderby, despite the luxury of steam and soap and water to his chin, did not linger in the bath. He had begun to hurry. For what? He did not know. But the cool sheets soothed him. The comfort of the bed was so exquisite that to sense it as long as possible, he tried to stay awake. The sleep into which he soon fell was dreamless and lasted till 7 p.m. He made tea in the big kitchen below street level and brought butter and cold roast chicken from a refrigerator and fine bread from a chrome and white cupboard. When he left the hotel, he was munching a sandwich made of the remnants of the meal. The Strand was gray, and in corners and gaping storefronts here and there, black. Rain had made scattered pools that gave the street a shabby, defeated look. The only light they reflected was the little in the sky. All the street lamps had failed now, and the store lights that had outlived the day were few and ineffectual. It was as Penderby looked round Trafalgar Square, somber and a little frightening, that he felt his first bewilderment, apart from the shocks of surprise of the day. He sat on a balustrade outside South Africa House and tried to plan the suddenly monstrous appearing future. He could not stay in the vast charnel house London had become. A day or two more, as he already had warned himself, and plague would ride every breath of air. But his food was in London. He could not turn farmer at short notice, and the supplies in stores and hotels would not last very long. The continent? But he could hardly manage a boat, even on the short Dover-Calais voyage, could he? Then he had not heard nor seen aircraft since the afternoon before. If airliners had come from France and other countries and landed at a dead airdrome, the pilots undoubtedly would have flown from Croydon onto London. Had everyone in France, Germany, Spain, Italy died? Was he the only one spared? Were there French, German, Spanish, Italian Edward Penderbys? The square was cold and lonesome. He left his perch stiffly and turned onto the strand once more. He tumbled over a body now and then. Clouds that had scudded from the west broke in a short, heavy shower, and it brought a damp smell from the heaps of wet clothes on every side. The hotel was in darkness, and he leaned against a bronze-encased pillar outside and began to smoke a cigar he had found in the bedroom. The dead he did not fear, but he was uneasy in the midst of so vast a number of them. Besides, the excitement of the day had left him a little nervous, and hours of wakefulness would be the price of his evening's sleep. Penderby began to wonder about the Thames. What had happened to the ships on the river, the men who had lived in them? A street nearby led to the water, and in 5 minutes he was leaning over the wall and trying to count the vessels in the dark. Two were little holiday steamers, heeled over slightly. One of the four or five motorboats had rubbed along the wall as the tide ebbed and was held in the angle of the nearer bridge. Warehouses and other buildings beyond the river were forbidding masses that added to the gloom of the water and hid all but a few mud gleams here and there. Penderby was sorry for having come. The scene was the most mournful the dead city had shown him. But he would not go back to the hotel yet. Approach of night seemed to have sharpened his senses, and the early afternoon restlessness had returned. A body lay 60 or 70 yards away, in the direction of Trafalgar Square. It was the only one in sight. The spread-eagled symmetry of it stirred his curiosity, and he walked quickly toward it. But something held him back, and his pace became slow, then very slow, and then he was trembling. He stooped over the body. Recognition came without a shock. He was looking at Edward Penderby, lanky, ill-shaven, in ragged clothes. But the eyes, wide open, were quiet, and the lines beside the mouth had softened. The man who had lived dropped on one knee and touched the angular forehead with an objective pity. "So you went too," he said. There still were some traces of what had been London when life came back to the earth. Green, creeper-tied heaps of concrete and steel, for instance, and flooded steel vaults beneath banks, and a few big guns in arsenals and presses now in rust under Fleet Street ruins. Rain, wind, heat, and cold had seen to the rest, and the two bodies, one well-dressed, the other shabbily, on a street beside the Thames, had been dust many a year. Why am I doing this? The thought was like a distant drumbeat in the back of Lucero's mind as he gently drew the needle from Sarah's arm, watching in fascinated horror as the clear liquid beaded like a perfect teardrop in the crook of her elbow. His hands shaking, he pulled the covers up to her chest. She stirred briefly, and Lucero stepped back, palming the syringe, but then she settled, her breathing becoming slow, deep, and even. Lucero thought he could even see a slight smile on her lips, but that may have been wishful thinking. He leaned over and kissed her forehead, his stomach a tight knot, then tossed the syringe into the wastebasket near the bed, where two used needles already lay blasphemously among crumpled tissues and empty soda cans. Through the cracks in the vertical blinds, he could see the setting sun blazing across the Mediterranean and the first fingers of cloud that signaled a storm to come. He glanced over at Sarah, and then at the children, who all looked snug and peaceful beneath their blankets. Their chests were still rising and falling with calm regularity, their lungs clearly imagining they had all the time in the world. Lucero plucked an apple from the basket on the table and stepped out onto the balcony. The beach below was deserted, which seemed a great shame. For some reason, Lucero had hoped to see hordes of humanity gathering together at the point of this breathtaking vista, exulting in the glorious sunset, in the sheer joy of being alive. He did not know precisely why, but he was surprised by how fervently he wished it, and surprised by the depth of disappointment he felt upon seeing the empty beach, seeing that he was enjoying the end of this marvelous day alone. He wanted to reach out and pull the universe into his embrace, to covet it like a jealous lover. He did not know why he had come here. He knew that this was the place Sarah loved most in all the world, the place where they had spent their honeymoon 15 years before. He tried to tell himself that this was the only reason he had come, but the drumbeat in his head was insistent. There had been recurring dreams that had seemed more like visions, of an endless series of pasts and futures that seemed to contain some core of himself, living and dying through the forms of others. There had been plans, research into painless poisons. And if he really admitted it to himself, there had been a distancing as he closed himself up, took himself away from the charmed circle of family. He did not know if Sarah or his children had felt it, but he most certainly had, and it had made these past few months in agony in search of finality. Lucero tossed the spent apple core onto the beach, where a sudden breeze immediately covered it with sand, obliterating it from view. He turned away from the darkening sky and trudged back through the glass doors. The interior of the hotel room was cool but pleasant, lit only by a single sconce above the bed. The children sprawled peacefully, their dark hair mingling on their shared pillow, their mouths still taking in the air through the tiny pink O's of their lips. Sarah still lay, hands folded over her chest. Lucero's heart clenched when he thought her life had faded away in his absence. But no, she still lived, though her breathing was so shallow that he could barely discern it. He pulled a chair alongside the bed and grasped her hand in his. He could not believe that a few short hours ago, this woman and these children had been running along the beach outside, their shoes dangling from their fingers, their shadows dancing across the Italian sands. The sound of their laughter as the waves lapped at their feet still seemed to echo down the ages, captured in the threads of space for eternity, there to be heard for those with the means to decipher. Their bodies now were so quiet, so still, seemingly incapable of anything so dynamic as sound, as movement. The incongruity of their past and present states made Lucero feel hollow, unmoored from his own flesh. For a moment, Lucero found himself wondering if Sarah would exist again, someday in a distant future, in a city unknown now, but built on the contingencies of the coming centuries. It was a bizarre idea, coming from seemingly nowhere, and he glanced behind him, almost as if he felt someone else had inserted it into his mind. The drumbeat in his head was becoming pronounced now, and it felt more and more as though some alien consciousness was working through him, propelling him to acts whose outcomes were repugnant, whose reasons were unclear to him. He thought he might perhaps be rationalizing what he suddenly realized was murder, and then he calmly considered the possibility that he might be crazy. He squeezed Sarah's hand tighter. He did not notice quite when it happened, but all at once he was aware of a strange silence in the room, a silence that he quickly attributed to the cessation of the sound of respiration from two sets of small lungs. The children were dead. He wanted to cry, bellow to the heavens, and he felt the emotion well up in him, but something between it and his skin acted as a barrier, and his outer shell remained unbroken. He felt as though he was inside a bottle, or perhaps watching a film starring a man who looked very much like himself. The sight of his two dead children, alive only seconds before and looking no less alive now, tucked into their large hotel bed, seemed academic, like an art installation. Lucero heard a distant peal of thunder from outside, then a streak of lightning that made the lamp above Sarah's bed flicker like the stuttering illumination of a firefly. Before the purple ghost of the flash had left his eyes, the hand he held went subtly limp, and Sarah's last breath escaped her lips like the ebbing of the tide on a faraway shore. Kay met Terry on the stairs of their apartment building. She was walking down, he was walking up. The stairwell was lit only by a single smudged light bulb behind a small metal cage. "Are you sure this is the best way?" Terry's brow was furrowed, leaving his dark eyes nothing but pools of shadow. Kay crossed her arms across her chest as if she'd felt a sudden chill. "Is there really a best way? It's the best way we could come up with." Terry nodded soberly. "I just hope everyone's asleep." "Well, it can't be helped if they're not." Kay's features were outlined in black, as though she hadn't slept for several days, which she hadn't. Without another word, she descended to the landing and pushed the bar on the red door that led to the boiler room. Terry followed, peering over his shoulder. When they emerged into the stairwell again, 15 minutes later, they were both shaking. The dimness and the damp and the complete silence made the recesses of the building feel like a mausoleum. Neither of them spoke as they ascended one flight to ground level, then made their escape through the rear fire door, which was supposed to be alarmed, but which, as far as either of them knew, never had been. The streets of Chaitu Mall were eerily empty at this hour, and though there was no need to hurry, Kay and Terry nonetheless strode swiftly away from the building they'd both called home for nearly a decade. Terry glanced back once, peering up at the darkened windows. "What about Mrs. Alvarez? She's always up late reading." "Terry, stop. It's too late now." Kay's old blue Ford was parked around the corner, and she unlocked it, the sound of the key in the lock like a scream. They got in and closed the doors, breathing hard. After a few moments of staring straight ahead through the windshield, Kay reached into her bag and pulled out a pack of cigarettes. She offered it to Terry, but he shook his head. Kay lit up and puffed in silence for several minutes, filling the car with a sharp gray smog. She did not roll down the windows, and Terry did not ask her to. Their building was no longer in sight, but Terry still stared out the window in its general direction, as if he'd be able to witness the rooms filling with carbon monoxide, see the lives snuffed out behind the dark windows. "We just killed 57 people." His voice was as soft as a breath. Kay stubbed out her cigarette and lit another. "It doesn't matter now, Terry. You know that." "I know." He glanced over at her, his wide face a mask floating in the smoke. "Should we do more then? I mean, we'd be doing them a mercy." Kay's chin began to tremble, but she sniffed and got a hold of herself. "It was hard enough just doing this, Terry. I wish I could do more." He nodded again. Another long moment passed while Kay finished her second cigarette and then reached out with a still unsteady hand to start the car. Its engine roared to life, and Terry winced. She maneuvered through the empty streets, not speaking until after she had driven clear of Chaitu Mall and exited onto the Carretera del Mundo Maya, heading toward Merida. "Do we know how to get in touch with Lucero?" she asked. Terry pulled a slip of paper out of his wallet. "I have his cell phone number here. I suppose I'll wait until morning to call him." "No, do it now," Kay said, squinting after the Ford's two bright headlights. "I have a strange feeling that there might be problems." Terry's head snapped up. "Problems? You mean you don't feel it?" "I don't know." He played absently with the buttons on his phone. "Maybe. You think Lucero won't come?" "He has to come. I just have other concerns. We'll call him and see what he says." "All right." Terry held the slip of paper up to the light, then dialed the number. Lucero had packed his things and now sat staring absently at his one pitiful suitcase. Sarah and the children were motionless shapes beneath white hotel sheets, and Lucero tried his best not to look at them, choosing instead to sit facing the sliding glass doors. The night had passed almost without his being aware of it, and now it seemed that dawn was approaching. He could not yet see the first rays of sunlight sparkling upon the waves of the Mediterranean, but he could still hear the whispering roar of the secretive waters as they pounded the beach beyond his window. He had no idea what his next move should be. It occurred to him that he should leave before anyone became suspicious, but for some reason he felt little fear that his deed would be discovered. He still was not sure why he had done it, and his heart still ached at the loss, but now he felt a strange calm also, as if everything would be taken care of, if only he could be patient for a little longer. His cell phone rang, loudly, but it did not startle him. Perhaps, he mused, he had been expecting it. Moving like a man in a dream, he reached into his pocket and put the tiny plastic phone to his ear. He listened. "Is this Lucero?" The voice on the other end was gritty, earthy, with an accent that suggested Mexico or Central America somewhere. "Yes?" A pause. "Do you know what day it is tomorrow?" Lucero was taken aback momentarily. He stuttered. "It's December 21st, isn't it?" There was another pause, then a sigh. It sounded as though the man had covered the phone with his hand. His voice was muffled as he spoke to someone on his end. After a moment, his words filled Lucero's ear again. "You have to come to Merida, do you understand? You must come immediately." "I killed my family." Lucero hadn't meant to say it baldly like that, but until he had spoken aloud, he hadn't realized how badly he had wanted to confess it. His eyes brimmed with tears. "I don't know why I did it. What's happening to me?" "It's all right, Lucero. You did the right thing." More muffled voices. What you need to do now is catch the first flight to Merida, okay? Where are you now? Lucero looked around the hotel room, for a second unable to remember where he was. Then it came to him. Amalfi Coast, Italy. The man blew air loudly between his lips. All right, you're far away, but you can still make it if you hurry. Do you know where Merida is? The name conjured up barely remembered visions in Lucero's mind. A swirl of dreamlike images from some other life, perhaps. I can't remember. It's on the Yucatan Peninsula, Lucero. You know where that is? Get a flight to the international airport, right? We'll pick you up and tell you what you have to do. We? That's not important now. You have to get here before tomorrow. Don't worry about anything else. Just get here as soon as you can. Call me when you've arrived. My name's Terry. All right, Terry. Lucero hung up the phone. Then, driven by some internal mechanism that had seemingly taken over his body at Terry's instruction, got to his feet, picked up his suitcase, and left the hotel room without once looking back at the three bodies he left in his wake. Hail Itzem Cab Ain. The follower, a man in fatigues with blonde dreadlocks, pressed an object into Delia's hand. When Delia opened her fingers, she saw that it was a tiny gold idol, a figure of a woman with a crocodile head. Emotion welled up within her, but she suppressed it with a force born of long practice. "Thank you, Marcus," she said, and laid her hand upon his shoulder. He closed his eyes and smiled, as if her touch had conferred the understanding of the ages upon him in one bright flash. Then he bowed his head and drank from the cup of green liquid in front of him. The smile remained on his face as he stretched out on the floor and crossed his hands upon his chest, waiting for the end. Delia watched the others as they drank, none hesitating in the slightest, and a wave of admiration for them managed to override her detachment. They were really the most extraordinary creatures, when they wanted to be. She looked again at the small gold idol in her hand. It was beautifully made. Marcus had been something of a genius in the art of shaping metals. It was a shame he would make nothing else, that everything he had made would soon disappear forever. She would keep this trinket, though, with its charming crocodilian features. It was sentimentality, she knew, but what harm was there? She sat in the farmhouse until the last of her followers had fallen still. She felt she owed them that much. The wide windows looked out upon a mountain vista capped with cotton-white clouds, and Delia spent a long moment in contemplation of the lives that had met their dignified finish beneath this sky, upon this particular patch of earth. Then she rose and made her way outside. A little more than an hour later, Delia slid her tortoiseshell sunglasses up onto her head and took an enormous bite of her second hamburger, absently wiping mustard from her chin. The sky was growing dark, but the sound and rubber smell of engines racing down the freeway seemed to be growing exponentially. Chewing, she watched the endless parade of winter travelers milling like bees around the rest stop's dubious nectar of snack foods and filthy conveniences. Most of them were clad in khaki shorts and t-shirts advertising mountain lodges. Even though it was nearly Christmas, Southern California was sweltering. Wolfing down the last bites of her food and then licking her fingers, Delia tossed the paper wrappers in the trash and got up from the picnic table, stretching her stiffening muscles. She hated long drives, but she hated flying even more. Being more than a few feet above the ground made her intensely uncomfortable. She tried to console herself by thinking that this road trip was likely the last one she'd be taking for a very long time, but she was still reluctant to fold her lithe limbs into her battered tin can on wheels. At last, she steeled herself and drifted to her car, starting it with a roar. The little gold crocodile statue grinned at her from its perch on the dashboard, and she returned its cheery expression. As she maneuvered out of the rest stop, she felt a wave of pity for the poor creatures in their straw hats and sandals, for their complete lack of awareness of impending events. She glanced back at them in her rearview mirror, but then made herself focus on the road ahead. It was certainly unfortunate that these hapless, largely harmless people might be terrified, perhaps suffer needlessly, but she had done her part for those closest to her. She couldn't spare everyone. Time was running out, and she had to be on the move. The sun warmed her skin through the windshield, and she soaked up the rays, feeling her body temperature rising pleasantly, fueling her with much-needed energy. Her brain was a boiling mass of emotions, from anxiety to elation to sorrow for all that she had left behind. Idly, she wondered if anyone had stumbled upon the bodies yet, if police had been alerted, if even now yellow crime scene tape was being strung around the perimeter of the farmhouse that served as a mass grave for her followers, the people she manipulated and controlled and loved more than anyone else in the world. She felt her mouth twisting into a smirk at the thought of the reports that would doubtlessly dominate the evening newscasts. Scene of unbelievable horror, they would say, faces held in mock sobriety, an American Jonestown. Perhaps there would even be out-of-focus photographs of her elusive form flashed upon the screen, descriptions of the one who had got away, the one who was likely responsible. Delia hoped, for the sake of her disciples, that their bodies had not been found, that they would rest quietly in their mountain retreat until the coming cataclysm wiped their deaths from the historical record, made them meaningless, non-existent, never existent. Delia wished this so passionately that she nearly crushed the steering wheel between her hands. Lucero had managed to secure a seat on a flight to New York, then on a connecting flight to Merida, but both planes were packed to capacity, and even in first class he felt oppressed by the closeness of the other travelers, who all seemed to be going home for the holiday. It seemed as though every spare niche in the aircraft was crammed with gaily wrapped packages, and Lucero had to look away from their festive physicality, suspecting they would never be opened. Instead, he stared out the window at the clouds cruising by far below. Some interminable amount of time later, he was crossing the terminal of the airport when his cell phone rang, this time startling him so severely that he nearly screamed. Several passengers looked at him oddly, and he gave them a smile he hoped looked reassuring, fishing the phone from his pocket. Without looking at the number, he put it to his ear. Yes? Hello, Lucero. A woman's voice now, speaking English but with a thicker accent than Terry's. Even though Lucero had never heard this particular voice before, it seemed intimately familiar to him, a voice from a dream. We're in the Blue Taurus, right out the doors past the leftmost baggage claim. Are you doing all right? The genuine concern in the woman's voice made Lucero relax somewhat. Yes, I think so, but I still don't know what's going on. A long pause. Well, we'll sort that out as soon as you get here. The phone crackled as a plane rumbled close overhead. I've reserved rooms at the villa, only a few blocks from the main square. Thank you. Lucero's voice was hoarse as he rang off. He didn't like this nervousness, this not knowing, this feeling that everyone seemed to be part of an intricate plot that he knew nothing about. To take his mind away, he focused on the relief of being off the cramped plane and in a country that he'd always wanted to visit but had never got around to. When he stepped through the sliding doors, out of the terminal and into the waning sunlight, the sky and earth and trees seemed to reach down and cradle him in warmth, in eternal familiarity. He spotted the car right away and jogged over to it, his slight suitcase bumping against his thigh. As he slid into the back seat, he took in the pair in the front, the man and woman whose voices had come to him from seemingly nowhere, as if they had known when his life had taken its darkest turn, when he most needed rescue. The man driving, presumably Terry, was burly and broad-featured, with leathery skin and a tumble of black curls. The woman, who turned and introduced herself as Kay, was willowy, delicate, her long dark hair shot through with strands of reddish gold. She smiled, though her brow was furrowed with concern. "It's nice to see you, despite the circumstances," she said. Her big eyes blinked once, twice, as she considered him. "You really don't know why you're here or what's happening, do you?" Lucero shook his head, feeling a vague sense of shame, as though he had disappointed her. She glanced over at Terry, who simply stared out the windshield as he pulled into the seething snarl of traffic surrounding the airport exit. "It's rather difficult to explain." "Why did I kill my Sarah?" Lucero asked, the enormity of his deed suddenly assaulting him anew, leaving his chest feeling so tight he thought it might implode. "Do you know why I did that?" Terry flicked a glance at him in the rearview mirror. "We also killed those nearest to us. Believe me, it was the merciful thing." Kay was twisting her hands in front of her and turned awkwardly in the passenger seat. "Oh, Lucero, how terrible for you not to remember. This has never happened before, not in all the years." She drifted off again, her beautiful, airy face a mask of consternation. Terry made a turn, narrowly missing an old man on a bicycle. "Maybe it would be better to just tell him outright," he said, casting a sidelong look at Kay. Lucero looked first at Terry and then at Kay, feeling that they were opposites and yet somehow still one, and that they seemed much larger than they appeared, as though they both had powerful magnetic fields emanating from their bodies. He was sweating beneath his clothes, desperate for some shred of understanding, of information. Kay turned toward the front of the car again. "Maybe we should wait for Delia, wait until we're all together." "What for?" "I don't know, maybe Delia would be better at telling him." Terry nodded slowly. Maybe. Who is Delia, and what is she supposed to tell me? Lucero asked, feeling peevish and not wanting to sound so, in case his saviors became angered. They glanced at each other again, their eyes wide in shared conspiracy. Kay did not seem to want to answer, but Terry apparently took pity on him. Delia is Itzam Cab Ain, he said, nosing the car through the dusty streets. She is the eater of the futures. It was nearly evening when they arrived at the hotel. It was an imposing structure, all arches and orange stucco, two stories presiding over a surrounding lake of green grass and white winter blossoms. Kay and Terry had been nothing but friendly during the remainder of the trip, but Lucero was still frustrated by their reluctance to talk more about the apparent mystery surrounding them. They checked into the hotel and had a valet take Lucero's bag up to his room. The two of them evidently had no luggage, which disturbed Lucero immensely. The three of them then sat on the veranda of the attached restaurant, drinking coffee. Kay and Terry did not ignore him, but they mostly spoke between themselves. The rhythm of their voices was strangely soothing, like wind through wheat fields. Lucero was just beginning to come to terms with the surrealistic turn his life had taken, and was beginning to accept the fact that he may never completely understand what was happening to him, when he glanced up and out across the grass, and there, he knew, was Delia. Her voluptuous figure swayed beneath a green silk caftan, and her eyes were hidden by dark glasses despite the fast approaching night. She moved not gracefully, but not clumsily. Her motion was inevitable, unaware, the gait of a loping animal. For a moment, she too seemed enormous, slithering, and the aura of power streamed from her in thick, verdant waves. As Lucero stared, the lawn and street below seemed suddenly to swim, and Delia's looming frame looked large enough to swallow the world. Lucero gripped the edges of the table to anchor himself in reality, but for what seemed like a very long time, he drifted, unmoored, and it was only after much effort that he was able to regain some semblance of normality. Delia slid into a chair opposite him, taking off her glasses and studying him with flat, yellowish eyes. Without preamble, she said, "Are you going to be able to do this, Lucero?" He was frozen, prey before a hungry predator. The cold seemed to radiate from her like pale blue light. Before he could stammer out an answer, Kay swooped in. "Delia, he doesn't know." She almost growled as her head whipped to confront Kay. "Doesn't know? How can he not know?" Kay shrugged, clearly not intimidated by Delia at all. "Stranger things have happened, I suppose." Delia's mouth twisted, but she looked almost amused. Her reptilian gaze fell on Lucero again. "Bolon Zankab," she said. Lucero stared at her, then at the others, wondering if this was all some elaborate joke at his expense. "What?" Delia sat back in her chair, her tongue lazily flicking across her lips. "Very interesting. I wonder why he's forgotten." Terry sipped from his coffee cup. "He had a wife, children," he said. At the mention of his family, Lucero stiffened. What have they got to do with anything? It suddenly occurred to him that he had confessed to killing Sarah and the girls, that if Kay and Terry wanted to, they could turn him in. Why had he told them? They were clearly not going to help him. They were simply looking at him as though he was a bug under a microscope. Delia was nodding, her eyes slitted knowingly. Yes. It never pays to get too close to them. Now we see why. What are you talking about? Lucero was gripping the handle of his cup so hard that he thought he heard the ceramic crack. Tell me what's going on. He supposed he could just get up and leave, but where would he go? He was a murderer in an unfamiliar country. It would only be a matter of time before he was caught. Kay took his hand in hers, and though his first instinct was to pull away, she stroked his fingers gently until he submitted. We're sorry about this, Lucero, she said, and her voice was honeyed, sky blue spring. It's just that this is so unusual. Normally, when a rebirth comes around, we're all on the same page, as it were. She smiled weakly. Rebirth? Lucero whispered. Delia put her palms flat upon the tabletop. Basically, the situation is this, she said. Tomorrow is the last day before the rebirth of the world, the start of a new 5 millennial age. We've been presiding over these rebirths for forever, Terry said, and the three of them laughed. As good as, Delia said. Now, when the cataclysm begins... The what? Delia sighed. For heaven's sake, Lucero, we haven't got much time here. Just pipe down and I'll tell you what you need to know. Now, as I said, it all goes down tomorrow, precisely at dawn. It will happen whether or not we are here to oversee it, but if we were not here for some reason... It wouldn't be a rebirth, Kay broke in quietly. It would be the end, the true end. Precisely. A waiter hovered into view, and Delia ordered more coffee and an almond pastry before sending him away with a flick of her oddly claw-like hand. Then she pointed a finger at Lucero. You, Bolan Zakab, have the most important duty of all. It will probably all come back to you when the Five Hills rise up again, but in a nutshell, you are the one who chooses the next future, the next five millennial existence. Understand? Lucero stared hard into her face, looking for some clue that she was teasing him, winding him up. But she only blinked matter-of-factly. Kay and Terry looked on with serious and slightly anxious expressions. After a moment, he laughed, a burbling cackle that startled him as it came out of his mouth. I understand that you're all crazy, he said. Delia leaned forward, her features blazing intently. Listen to me. Deep down, you know what I'm saying is true. It's inside you, Lucero. You have lived many lifetimes, in many different bodies, always waiting for this day to come. Tell me, when you first got here, you thought you had been here before, didn't you? Lucero turned away violently, but she had seen his shocked expression. She smiled. And you've been having dreams ever since you can remember. Dreams of living as other people, in other times. But they aren't dreams, Lucero. You did live them. You can remember if you try. Lucero didn't want to try, didn't want to feel as though these three strange people knew more about him than he knew about himself. What were they doing to him, reminding him of visions he wanted forgotten? Were they somehow controlling his thoughts even now? Had they been the ones who made him kill Sarah and the girls? His hands shook. Delia sighed. We're not getting anywhere. She peered out over the railing, taking in the city below as if some answer could perhaps be found there. Evening had fallen fully upon Merida, and though the night had turned unseasonably cool, the throngs of people and the rush of traffic had barely dissipated. From the veranda, it appeared that the city lights went on forever, coating the underlying darkness, the glowing speckles of modernity a thin covering over the black unknown seething beneath. Lucero thought again of how he could leap from the veranda, disappear into the night among strangers, perhaps find some manner of escaping this country, this life. As though she had read his mind, Delia placed her hand gently but firmly upon his arm. Let's go up to our rooms. Maybe a rest will put you in a better frame of mind, she said. We could all use a rest, I think, said Terry. Big day tomorrow, said Kay, and then laughed awkwardly and looked down at her hands. Lucero, you'll be all right, won't you? Delia's yellow gaze was hard, distrustful, but not without kindness. Lucero brought his trembling cup to his lips and drained the coffee from it. His brain was a hive of confusion, as though his entire being had become fragmented and now struggled to reassemble itself, but kept coming out wrong, shreds of memory and personality and deed all tangling up together like knotted twine. I'll be all right, he said, though he choked upon the words. Of course, he was not all right. I need to sleep. Of course you do. Delia watched him as he rose unsteadily to his feet. She and the two others followed close at his heels as he entered the hotel, and Lucero got the distinct impression that they were blocking his escape routes, treating him like a criminal. He winced at the stifling heat in the lobby, hitting him full in the face after the pleasant coolness outdoors. He was aware that people seemed to be staring strangely at him, and for a panicked moment he was sure they knew who he was, that the murders of his wife and children were stamped in 3-foot letters upon his flesh. Despite this, he was tempted to plead for help with his eyes. "Get me away from here," he wanted to say, hoping that one or more of them would intervene, push aside the three insane people who had kidnapped him, tuck him into bed and tell him that everything that had happened over the last few days had been nothing but a terrible dream. But he did nothing of the sort. He simply shuffled to the elevator in the midst of his group of jailers and ascended to the 5th floor. Delia's eyes sprang open in the darkness, every cell of her body seeming to quiver. She did not know exactly what time it was, but she had a feeling that in some sense it was already too late. She had not meant to fall asleep tonight, and for the first few hours after the four had retired to their rooms, she had lay on her belly across the bed, keeping perfectly still, watching the lights of Merida winking out one by one. But eventually the stress of the past days and the forced languor of the long drive had caught up to her, and she had drifted off. Now, though, she knew something was wrong. She slid out of bed, listening at the walls. Terry and Kay could be heard moving around in their room, apparently as reluctant to sleep as she. but from Lucero's room was only silence. Delia sighed heavily. She had known something like this might happen, but she hadn't wanted to force the issue with Lucero, making him stay in the room with her or the others, making him feel like a prisoner. She knew in some sense he already felt that, but she also knew that in his heart of hearts he knew what he was and what he needed to do. She had just been hoping that this realization would come to him before his panicky human veneer could override the godly duty residing in his very genes. Evidently, this had not happened. Delia shrugged into her clothes, annoyed at Lucero but also at herself, for not being able to convince him to show him the way. A glance at the bedside clock revealed the time to be nearing 3 a.m. There was still time to find Lucero before events began to unfold in earnest. She did not know how long ago he had absconded, but he was in a strange city and likely hadn't gotten far. As she stepped out into the hallway of the hotel, she saw that Kay and Terry were emerging also, matching expressions of exhaustion tainting their lovely brown faces. Without a word, the three formed a small huddle and moved as one toward the elevator. Lucero was bleary-eyed, but curiously wide awake. He had no idea where he was or where he thought he was going. He only knew he had to get away from those people, from everything he'd done. The sunrise was still more than an hour off, but a soft pinkish glow had begun to emanate from beyond the horizon, garlanding the edges of the modern buildings with a clear liquid light. He stopped a moment and stared at the fading stars, wondering why he felt that he was at some kind of crossroads. An ending, yes, but perhaps also a beginning. Shaking himself out of the strange visions that had started to nibble at the corners of his consciousness, he set off walking down the side of a deserted road that led out of Merida and toward the main highway. Perhaps when the sun came up, he could hitchhike, find someone who could help him get back home, although he wasn't sure he knew where that was anymore. With falling spirits, he realized that he could never go back there anyway. He was a marked man. Lucero wasn't certain how long he had been walking, but the light in the sky had begun to change from pink to orange and was just beginning to shade into yellow when he realized he felt something happening to the ground beneath his feet. For a time, he kept walking, resolutely, unwilling to acknowledge the sensation, but a few more steps told him he could no longer ignore it. He stopped and looked around, his heart fluttering. Was it an earthquake? It certainly felt like that, but there was also something else, some sort of harmonic tone just beyond the threshold of hearing. Lucero twisted and turned wildly, looking for something or someone who could explain what was happening, but the roads around him were still deserted at this time of the morning. A sudden jolt sent him flying, and he landed with a painful thud on his right side. Cradling his arm, he sat up, feeling the ground trembling beneath him, and then there was another jolt, several times more powerful than the last, that rattled his bones against the inside of his skin. He tried to stand, but the earth no longer felt solid, and he slipped to the ground again, terrified and covered in mud. As he sat on the ground, wondering at its treachery and trying to think of a way out of his predicament, he thought he saw in the darkness an enormous snake making its way like a lightning strike toward him. He recoiled before realizing that what he had seen was actually something far worse than a snake. It was an enormous crack in the earth, zigzagging at him almost purposefully, like a crooked-mouthed beast aiming to swallow him whole. He screamed and rolled aside, feeling the crack rocket past him, and then the harmonic sound seemed to grow many times louder, as if it emanated from the very core of the earth and was released by the opening of the ground. And then there was another sound, one which he had heard many times, but in this context seemed particularly out of place. It was the roar of a nearby ocean. The moment he heard the mysterious shush of the waves, he smelled them also, a deep, salty smell that seemed to hold all of the secrets of humankind to its black breast, seemed to hide their hopes in its unfathomable depths. As he stared transfixed into the gigantic crack in the earth that had narrowly missed eating him alive, he saw the waters climbing the walls of the chasm, rushing headlong toward the surface. The ocean was nearly to the lip of the fissure when Lucero felt a light brush of a breeze across his cheek, and in the dawning light a shadow fell across his prone form. Gazing upward, he thought perhaps he had died without realizing and now languished in the care of the angels, though it was Kay's face that hung above him. "There you are," she seemed to say, though her words meshed with the harmonies, making them difficult to discern. She seemed to encompass the entire firmament, a beautiful countenance made of stars and galaxies and darkness. It seemed that she smiled at him, and he felt as though he smiled back, and then he remembered nothing for a little while. When Lucero awoke, he found himself standing in the middle of a large cobbled square, the center of the city of Merida. with empty benches watching like sentinels from the sidelines. The ground still shook, the sounds of music and rushing water still filled his ears, but now he felt strangely calm, as if his body was no longer his own, as if he was watching this happen from somewhere very far away. He glanced to his left and his right and saw them, Kay and Terry and Delia, and they looked the same but also somehow different, lighter, less defined. Lucero closed his eyes, feeling a chill breeze whispering across his face. Even with his eyes closed, Lucero knew that lightning had begun to arc across the sky. He could feel the hairs on his body standing up with the electricity. The wildness of the feeling excited him. He felt some affinity with the lightning, thought of it as a brother element. The visions that had haunted him for as long as he could remember came fast now, flashing by in the red-black space behind his eyelids, but for some reason they no longer caused him any fear. He opened his eyes. The ground continued to shake, and somewhere far away he heard people shouting, screams of anguish. This made him apprehensive for a moment, and he glanced at the others to gauge their reactions, but their expressions were stoic. Delia gave his hand a cursory squeeze, as if to tell him that things were exactly as they should be, and he relaxed back into his detached state. More great cracks began to appear, branching across the paving stones in patterns mimicking the forking of lightning across the still dim sky. And then the ocean came boiling up from the depths of the planet, steaming waters tipped with foaming white caps, angry and insatiable. Lucero watched the levels rise, feeling as though his entire body was surging with light and power. He then turned fully to his kidnappers, his compatriots. Kay seemed to be growing, yet at the same time becoming less present, more ethereal, her molecules dissolving into the surrounding air. After a few moments, all he could see of her was her light, solemn face and her outstretched arms like enormous blue wings, encompassing the atmosphere beneath their shelter. Terry was also growing, but he appeared to be growing darker, bulkier, spreading himself even wider as he sank into the yielding dirt. His strong features seemed stamped in the very surface of the emerging soil, an eyebrow or a smirk caught in the coincidental patterns of the trembling earth. Delia was not disintegrating into the atmosphere the way the others were, but she was nonetheless getting larger, her limbs becoming shorter and more muscular, her face protruding forward, her nose becoming a pointed snout, her flesh becoming hard and plated. From the position she adopted, lying on her belly with her powerful tail flicking behind her, she stared up at Lucero, with the same golden reptile eyes that had considered him from beneath her tortoiseshell sunglasses. He wondered idly what he looked like to her now, whether the electricity coursing through his veins was making of him a glowing, sizzling figure of forking limbs and burning eye. The cracks in the ground before them became chasms, and through the paving and metal of modern Merida rose the ancient city of Ikenzijo, which always lay in wait, the past bubbling endlessly beneath the present. The sound of the sky and the earth collapsing and separating was deafening, drowning out the cries of any humans who were still alive to witness it. The veneer of Merida fell easily away as though it was made of paper, a cardboard city, and through its ruins rose the five hills of Ikenzijo, green and lush with vegetation that smothered one with the scent of persistent life, cyclical life, that died and died again, only to be reborn ever after, resilient, stubborn, immortal. Kay, with her cape of blue, held the sky above like curtains, while Terry below them served as the stage upon which to act. The sun was coming up through the clouds, its bright disk just visible behind the five hills. It signified day one, the resetting, the rebirth. The water had just begun to spill over the cracks and rush to fill the flat land in gobbling torrents. Lucero peered down at his dampening shoes and then at Delia's crocodile form, which was so large that her eyeline was nearly level with his chest. She blinked at him, a gesture of assent, of encouragement. Lucero hesitated for a moment only, the last vestige of his human form making its uncertainty felt. Then he let go, allowing the blazing divinity he'd always harbored in the recesses of his soul to come forward and do its sacred duty. Taking one last look at the silhouette of the five hills stretching up into the brightening sky, he began to ascend the leftmost hill, with Delia dragging along close behind. At the apex of the hill, Lucero stopped to take in a scene he would not lay eyes on for another five millennia or more. The sky was black above the sunrise, and the wings of Kay's cape had become a whirling vortex of even blacker mass, like storm clouds coughed up from the mouth of Xibalba itself. Rain was falling in great buckets, adding more water to the oceans that rose from the cracks in the earth. Very soon, the five hills were small, evenly spaced islands in a vast and endless sea that heaved ever upward as the rainwater battered its surface. By the glow of his own inner fire, Lucero could make out the temple in the center of the hill, a great tree with branches reaching toward the heavens, its trunk as thick as 1,000 men. The tips of the stretching fingers nearly touched those of the tree on the next hill, forming a broken web of wood and leaf. Lucero approached the temple, hearing Delia's claws parting the grass behind him. The tree hung heavy with round fruits that glinted like silvery jewels, like diamonds, as his light neared it, and within each fist-sized fruit was the cycling flicker of possibility. He felt his eyes burning in their sockets as he contemplated the fruits nearest to him, the lives and fates playing out upon their surfaces. They were all so beautiful, and all seemed to whisper to him, their glittering shine flashing at him like a saucy wink. "We are the future," they all seemed to say. "It is we you must choose, we who must live." Lucero felt a twinge of hesitation again, an ache of regret. The human shell was apparently not so easily cast aside. The centuries he had just lived through were gone forever. They were not anywhere here, hanging full and ripe from any of the five trees. Sarah was not here. The existence of every person he had ever been and known was erased. With the new fruit he picked, history would be rewritten, and there was no one save himself and his compatriots who would remember that there had ever been other eras, other cycles, overlapping endlessly in the same fold in time. In another 5,200 years, he would stand here again, the future he picked now vanished beneath the waves of the great sea. Was it as pointless as it all seemed? Was the fact of humans' existence in any time important if after mere millennia it was all snatched away, subsumed, utterly replaced and forgotten? Delia clacked her jaws behind him, regarding him with her yellow eyes. She was growing impatient, but he could also see understanding in her reptilian gaze. Lucero supposed it was not for him to question his duty to the great wheel of the universe, the cycle of existence. What difference did it make, in the end, which future he chose? Whichever fruit he plucked would guarantee sorrow and tragedy. But also there would be joy, hope, happiness, love, mercy. For wasn't that also the way of the human, the inevitable byproduct? Delia seemed to smile at him as though she had read his thoughts and was glad to see that he finally understood. Then again, Delia's crocodile form always seemed to be smiling. Lucero plucked a shimmering silver fruit from a high branch near the center of the temple, and after only a moment's contemplation of the future it contained, he tossed it to Delia, who caught it handily between her open jaws and swallowed it with obvious relish. Kay and Terry were instantly beside him again, their human forms still wavering around the edges. They touched his face, murmured congratulations. Feeling as though a great weight had been lifted from his shoulders, feeling the anticipation of his three friends in godhood, Lucero stepped back from the tree, waiting for the waters to subside.